Okay, we continue our meeting with a discussion on amendments to IES 8. I give the floor to Nadia.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Agenda paper 7. This paper deals with amendments to IES 8 that aim to clarify the distinction between changes in accounting policies and accounting estimates. The agenda paper contains the wording of the draft amendments to IS 8 on pages 5 to 7. The wording of these amendments is exactly the same as the wording that we presented to the board in April of this year. We plan to ask the board in September for its permission to go ahead with the exposure draft. But before we ask the board for this permission, we thought that we should talk to you about your views about the amendments, which is the purpose of our discussion today. I would also like to mention this, that this project is a joint project between the ISB and the Italian Standard Setter, OIC, and EU is representing the Italian Standard Setter today. So with all this said, now we are going to discuss our first and main question of the agenda paper on page 9. And this question is, do you believe that the amendments, as described in the agenda paper, would provide sufficient improvement to justify the board to go ahead and publish the exposure draft?
Andreas.
Yes.
We want to wrap up this meeting. Linda.
You want an explanation, sorry.
No.
Go, thank you, okay.
As long as it just...
Well, I agree.
Okay, next.
Just a few comments. So this particular issue, whether an item is a change in estimate or a change in policy, from the preparers I speak to, and as well as my background as preparer, you spend way too much time thinking about it and talking about it. Based on, it is one of those situations where the audit firms read the words a certain way, and there is so much churn. So our stakeholders would be happy to respond to this. You would not be wasting their time because there's all this other wasting of the time that goes on. So, views I'm expressing are my own. Okay, there you go. Where's Chris? I think this is being recorded. But anyway, so we would encourage you to do that. I noted that in the paper you said you had done outreach with firms and stuff, but didn't seem like you talked to any preparers. I would encourage you to do that. We can connect you with preparers in our jurisdiction. And the other thing I noted is that at the back where you say, which I can't find right now, but you talk about the change in a measurement basis, but you didn't really elaborate, you didn't have examples. In this whole communication, to the extent that you can give examples to help get your points across, that will be hugely beneficial. And again, we'd be prepared to help you with those.
Andrew.
Strongly agree about the need for examples, and that relates to what my word. Yes is also my answer overall. This is, you came from the Interpretations Committee, and there's clearly some overlap between the existing definitions of accounting policy and accounting estimate that do cause problems in practice, from my experience. In stripping back the definition of accounting policies just to principles, we did get some input. Maybe you've just stripped back a bit too far, but maybe that can be addressed through some examples. But I wondered about, for example, the decision to use a practical expedient in the low credit risk exemption in IFRS 9. Is that an example of an estimate or an accounting policy? I'm not quite sure if it's an accounting principle. It doesn't sort of feel like it to me, to be honest. But maybe just a little bit too shipping about, but examples might be the way forward on that. Yeah, it's interesting setting a sort of threshold for a change in accounting estimate. And the words here seem perfectly fine and inoffensive. You know, basically only make a change in an estimate if it's going to be just as good or better, to paraphrase slightly, which is hard to object to. But of course, financial statements are just an accumulation of many estimates. And I just wonder if this could have setting a threshold for making any kind of a change in estimate, given you make estimates pervasively in each set of financial statements could have some unintended consequences, but for an exposure draft, I think it's worth exploring the question. And we also split changes in accounting estimates between those that require an estimation or valuation technique and everything else. Which again, on the face of it seems like it might be okay, but at some level, depending on how you read the words, then every accounting estimate requires some kind of estimation technique. So I sort of feel I know what we're getting at, but just thinking perhaps to my former job more in the application part of the business, I just wonder if this might lead to some problems down the track. So worth considering. And finally, a really detailed point, if we're going to make some changes to this part of ISA, then maybe we're going to update the language on an example of what might need an estimate is an estimate of bad debts. I think we do need to estimate expected credit losses now, rather than may need to make an estimate of bad debts.
Jim?
Similarly, thought this was very helpful. We have the same debate in the U.S. from time to time. And similar to Andrew's point, it's hard to argue with the notion that if you're going to change a technique, it should be equal or a better reflection, although I do wonder whether that could cause issues down the road. Say that I hire a third-party valuation firm that is exceedingly costly, and I could take that over in-house, and it might be slightly less refined, but the cost-benefit says I don't need to incur this cost. This would potentially preclude you from doing that, of saying, well, you adopted a very, very costly technique, and anyone that is less refined is now precluded from being adopted, and particularly depending on what you think an expedient is, might say if you didn't initially adopt an expedient, you're forever forestalled from adopting that expedient because that, of course, is potentially viewed as less refined. Yeah. And so that language could be potentially problematic because it doesn't allow entities to consider cost benefit.
You picked up on this threshold, which is actually a question too, but I'm fine if you guys overlap in terms of answering questions. But what's your overall impression, like in terms of, is it worth proceeding with these amendments? For the
I thought the amendments themselves were great. It was just a question about whether you wanted to be that precise or if there is room for sort of a cost-benefit evaluation in changing technique. But overall, I thought it was very helpful.
Yeah, we have some doubts, as you could say, like internally, and that's why we're asking questions. Do we really need to keep this threshold? Yeah, but thank you.
Yeah, you almost... when you asked the question, it was almost like, do you really believe that this could be
that's what I want to know. because all discussions come to this question ultimately. So, thank you.
Kimberly.
Overall, we did agree that the these were improvements and were worth proceeding with. In terms of how you proceed, which I know you haven't got to question three yet, but I mean, our thoughts were that it didn't need to be a separate exposure draft. I think we've talked before in this forum about packaging things up, either in annual improvements, or I know in the past there was criticism putting potentially bigger issues in annual improvements, and that was why things ended up in separate EDs. Whether, if that's still a concern, there might be another mechanism by some sort of omnibus ED of limited scope amendments. In terms of the actual proposals, we did think that there were some issues that you could talk about. Like I know in the other paper there was talk about the IS2 inventory question about changes from FIFO to weighted average, and the conclusion was what people have figured that out. I think people have largely solved that debate because of the specific wording in IS2 around disclosures. And if there were a revamp of IS2 disclosures at any point in the future that lost that, I think we'd go back to debating. I've certainly had in practice some fierce debates with people about, is it a change in estimate or is it a change in policy, including knowledgeable technical people. In terms of the threshold of the change in estimate, we had feedback both in New Zealand and Australia that we were concerned about that, introducing that threshold, and I really think it's more of an elaboration of the points that Jim was making there, is because we could see situations where it would be quite legitimate to change to a less robust technique. One example that was given is, say, you started off with, say, an asset you were valuing, it could be PP&E or financial instruments that you were valuing, using an external valuer, very costly exercise, but over time that particular asset became less significant due to changes in your business grew, or maybe there were equity instruments and you sold off a chunk of them, and now when you're looking at what you've got left, you're concluding actually that's not particularly material to me anymore, and a less robust technique could be just as good as a more robust technique because you're expecting that the difference wouldn't be material. And as a consequence, it might be perfectly valid to move to a less robust technique. So we weren't supportive of introducing a threshold because we felt that really that you do have to evaluate the move in the context of everything that's going on in the ETF. I think there's maybe an underlying assumption in putting in this threshold that nothing else changed, and therefore it was a bad thing to change it, but other things could have changed.
Thank you. And most of members of the AOSG agreed with changing the definition of adding the paragraph. But one member has raised several concerns relating to the draft amendment, including the definition is very abstract and lacks guidance in practice. For each examples of changes in accounting policies, need providing the ISB should consider deleting the threshold equally or more representative, and current IS 8 only defines accounting policies and changes in accounting estimates. Therefore, the ISB should define accounting changes, accounting estimates, and changes in accounting policies as well. Furthermore, regarding question 2C, one member believed that the ISB should consider deleting the threshold equally or more representative for a change in estimation techniques or valuation techniques to meet the definition of changes in accounting estimates. The rationales for this argument are it is likely to be interpreted that the estimates should justify a change in accounting estimate, like a change in accounting policy. If the justification of changing estimation techniques is to be required, it may be a change of accounting policies rather than that of accounting estimates. I think if the choice of estimation techniques depends on management's discretionary decision between the multiple techniques, it might be a policy. So applying the threshold only for a change in estimation techniques or valuation technique is inconsistent with the fact that there is no threshold for other changes in accounting estimates. We can refer to IS 37, as IS 37 recognizes, requires to provide best estimate. It can be reasoned that an estimation technique to generate the best estimate should be the best estimation technique. Of course, under the constraint of cost or benefit. In this sense, if an estimation technique is changed, the change should be mandatory to provide the best estimate. So there is no justification for a change in estimation technique. That's our opinion.
You're not supporting the threshold.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mary.
A few people have suggested that examples might help, you know, with the clarity of the proposals. And one thing I wanted to ask for some more input on is whether you're talking about in the surrounding materials, let's say if we did some education materials or others at the time we issued this, or whether you're talking about adding them to the document, the standard or accompanying examples. And I think one of the concerns that we've had throughout this project is that if we start to add too many examples, it becomes a, well, it's on the list and therefore it must be X, and if it's not on the list, then we really don't know, because the list of examples could get very long very fast. So, I mean, a general plea I have, assuming that we do go out with an exposure draft, is if you're talking with people and momentum is building for examples, to try and help people think about restraining that, or whether they're better in, they can still help if they're in separate material, and so not just examples that are not authoritative in the document, but in separate material, or if you think we really need lots more examples in the document itself. So that's a kind of a caution / question about that suggestion.
Andreas.
Still yes. In answering your question, I think I personally don't feel that more examples are needed. If people feel differently, I'd rather include them in the standard and not in the education material. And that's basically for one reason. I think it's the difference in due process. So whilst you can say, if you kept that in educational material, as long as you make sure that the educational material is available at the same point in time that you start the due process on that exposure document, so that people see the two in tandem and could react, I think that adds benefit to it. Personally, I always think that educational material is really supplementary material. The standard should be sufficient on its own, and if people feel that that is not, then it seems to suggest that something in the standard is needed. One issue that I would like to flag is calibration of models. That doesn't seem to be in that particular list. So what we regularly see is that valuation models get changed because they get calibrated. And the question is, as of when is a calibration big enough to actually lead to a change in accounting principle or accounting method? Because all the models are continuously updated, and it's not just because of input information, but it's really the model itself has changed over time. A more general thought that you might think of is, we seem to be a bit wordsmithing in here, in that we seem to be focusing really on two accounting constructs, being estimates and changes in principles. The underlying question, I suppose, is when, if at all, is accounting information, prior accounting information, restated or not? Mm-hmm. That's the underlying question that we really are focusing on. And it might help if you think about this entire document more from that angle and make a robust statement, a key principle, saying, for instance, past information is never updated. That's the core principle. And then there is an exception, which seems to be following from what I read in here, because you've raised the bar for something to be really an accounting change in accounting principle, and you label that an exception and provide some justification as to why you believe that makes a strong enough case as to why past information should be updated. Because I think that really is the key question. Why do we go back and change prior information? Because otherwise, I think that debate would easily go away. If you say, well, you never update, then this becomes a philosophical debate. So the driver for distinguishing between the two is really focused about updating prior information and giving some justification as to why this is okay here and nowhere else would help. This goes beyond a mere change in fixing the language. And when I say we are fine with publishing an exposure draft and taking up Kimberly's point, bundling that together with other exposure documents at the same time, it's really because I think it provides clarity in its own right. So especially paragraph 34A we found quite useful. But
thank you. Generally we are supportive of providing some clarification. Probably not in the form of a separate exposure draft, but probably bundled together as part of an annual improvements or something along those lines. Just a couple of comments, though, is that there is some doubt as to whether or not there is enough clarity to be able to distinguish the point that I think Kimberly was raising on IS2, is whether or not the FIFO weighted average is at a principle, you know, in an accounting standard, or is the principal cost, and is that simply meant to be a way of estimating? So I think there is still some uncertainty as to whether or not it does go far enough in providing clarity. And then the other interesting thing point that came up is that perhaps in practice there could be corrections of errors sort of dressed up to be changes in estimates. So again, maybe picking up on the point that Andrea's made, you know, making that distinction and clarity around when information should be restated and when shouldn't it be. I mean, obviously we don't want errors just to be, you know, say dressed up as changes in estimates. So I think, you know, those distinctions, you know, need to be made very clear.
Noble.
Yes, thank you. We are afraid we need to say that that there needs to be more work to be done before issuing an ED, and we have three comments we'd like to make. The first is that the definition of accounting policy is simpler now. The proposed definition is simple, but it will come down to what specific principles means, and as some have already indicated, we aren't sure where the line is drawn. For example, if you say the principle is to measure inventory at cost, then switching from FIFO to moving average doesn't really make a change. But if you're saying that the principle is to measure inventory at FIFO, then moving to another method is obviously a change. And we weren't sure where you were trying to draw the line, and that we think we need clarification. The second point we'd like to make is that the paper says that you won't define accounting estimates, but you will define changes in accounting estimates. And to us, that doesn't really make sense. So I think you should first define what accounting estimates are before you define what those changes are.
Can I just pick up on this one? Because currently ISA does not define accounting estimates. It defines accounting policies and changes in accounting estimates. And basically, we did consider this idea of defining accounting estimates, but we thought that this would go beyond the limited amendments to ISA, and therefore we just kept ISA as it is. We just walked with the definition. Like, there were certain limitations to what we could have done with
it. We weren't so concerned with what that limitation really meant. But we thought it would be easier to understand the standard if you can define first.
Yeah.
That would be our view. Yeah.
That was sort of inherited it a little bit in terms of that's how I say it has been written. But I see your point.
Okay. Our third point is that whether you use accounting estimates or changes in accounting estimates, your explanation refers to only assets and liabilities. And we think there are some cases where you are actually estimating the income or expense. For example, in IFRS 15, you have this requirement about variable consideration and the maximum amount you can recognize. And from our point of view, that is more about estimating an income or expense item rather than an asset or liability. So maybe you can expand the definition to refer to income and expenses as well.
Alberto.
I wanted to comment on the fact one of your constituents said that there is no threshold for accounting estimate, whereas there is for valuation technique. I'm not so sure that we don't have a threshold. If I read paragraph 34, it says an estimate may need revision if changes occur in the circumstances on which the estimate was based or as a result of new information or more experience. So there is no freedom to change the estimate unless something has occurred. Change in estimate, new information, more experience, which in simple words mean if you can do it if you can do a better estimation because of this change in circumstances. To me, this is a threshold or similar to a threshold. I have a problem with the last sentence in paragraph 35. When it is difficult to distinguish a change in an accounting policy from a change in an accounting estimate, the change is treated as a change in accounting estimate. Why? I mean, what is the justification? I would like to see, perhaps in the basis of conclusion, why you reach this conclusion. Because I would reach a different conclusion. Just to avoid people, you know, to treat accounting policy, change accounting policy, not to restate prior information, say, no, it's difficult to distinguish, we should go accounting estimate. I mean, I'm not happy with this last sentence.
Yes, I just wanted to mention, I get your point, but it's existing, it's the existing sentence of ISA. So we just basically kept it as it is.
As it is in the ISA 8, yes.
Currently, yeah. Just
we are trying to improve.
Just for the avoidance of doubt.
Point taken.
A couple of quick things. Just on the question whether this is assumed on a bundled or unbundled basis, I'm kind of agnostic, but it does feel to me like it's more than an annual improvement,
right.
I would have to say. Come back on examples, as I was one of people who thought examples might be helpful. I thought, presumably in developing this form of words, the project team have looked at various borderline cases, if you will, and done some internal testing on clarity of the wording applied against those internal examples. So one suggestion is to possibly then test this wording on some with a selection of constituents to see if they find it equally clear. And if the answer is no, perhaps ideally the best way would be to change the wording to make it sufficiently clear. But if that's not going to do the job, then some education guidance might be a good way forward. I would just say that if we do that, then can we get the education guidance published at the same time to sort of avoid the and develops in a parallel process to avoid the accusation that we're then sort of interpreting after the event, which has happened before.
Lucien?
Thank you. Just some quick comments. We think it's important to distinguish between the change in accounting policy and the change in accounting estimate. So we look forward to some improvement in this regard. Second, we think we support some clarification or guidance, maybe more clarification or guidance should be provided by the ISA. But based on current improvement in paper 7, we don't think ED is necessary for this version. Maybe we can use some other format.
So ED is not necessary?
Just as some AOSSG members said that because this improvement is too limited to issue an ED.
So you don't support to go ahead with this amendments, or you don't support to issue with a separate ED?
We hope more clarification or guidance, and then we can decide if we need a separate ED or we just to publish some educational material or something like that. So just based on the amendment in paper 7, agenda paper 7, we think it's not necessary to publish an ED. The third point is that based on Chinese practice, we use educational material to provide some guidance for the accounting practice in China. In our educational material, we have some examples and have some criteria to help the practice to help the preparers and auditors to make distinguish between changes in accounting policy and changing accounting estimates.
I presume it's in Chinese.
Stephen.
I've got three comments. So this IES2 problem, one or two of you have mentioned it. If the wording doesn't solve that problem, then I think we need to change the wording. And I don't think we should rely on separately published educational material to do that. So I think we need to think again if this group still thinks that that's not solved.
I was going to come to this example too. Do you need to address it now? Or, yeah, I might
you
as
can
well.
Do. I've got two more points,
okay,
but you
fine.
Go ahead.
Okay. Basically, this 508 leverage example, we have been having many discussions about this example. And this is an awkward one. So it doesn't sit comfortably with anything. And the main reason for that, I believe, is because IS2 is a very old standard. And perhaps if we were writing IS2 today, we would have assessed this classification policy estimate in completely different terms. And whatever we did with our wording, it just didn't sit comfortably with anything. So as I said, partly because it's an old standard and whoever wrote the standard came to this conclusion at that time, following the logic that interchangeable inventory should be treated differently from anything else. But in terms of like more practical solution to this issue, what do we do with it? Because like whatever we do with IS8 doesn't solve IS2. And basically what we are considering at the moment, so I do admit openly that it's an issue. So in terms of how we're going to address it, we have been considering this internally on several occasions. And basically, we believe that the most practical way forward with this example is basically to amend IS2.
I think so.
Because no matter what we do, it's such an awkward example that's the most realistic thing, I think, that we should do. And we're proposing, like, next time we go to the board, that's what we propose to do.
What exactly you propose? This is the first time
just
I've
to spell
this.
Out, and I think we...
Is it a consequential?
Either it's a consequential amendment or perhaps an annual improvement. We haven't decided yet. But basically what we were thinking of doing is to amend IS2 and to specifically state changes in 508 theory, just change in accounting policy, or is it change in accounting estimates?
Did you say or not?
It's a change of accounting policy
and not a change of accounting
estimate. So we believe that's the most practical thing we can do with this example.
So that means we don't think that it shows that the words we're thinking about are deficient, rather that case is so unusual that it would be better to deal with that directly rather than tinker with the words.
Are there no other cases similar to that?
Yeah.
I'm surprised there isn't something else.
But we did, and like there was another, like it's kind of related to the examples point, and perhaps I should have spent more time at the beginning explaining what we did internally. We did do quite a bit of informal testing, so to speak, and we plan to do more of that, and Linda will probably pick up your kind suggestion to use your contacts. But anyway, like we do plan, before we go ahead with DD, we do plan to do more testing of examples.
Yeah.
But so far, based on what we have done so far, and I think we've had three rounds in total, IS2 truly stands out as the most popular one.
What about the low credit risk exemption in IFRS 9, for example?
That's the first time I hear about that. It hasn't come up yet. So.
Well, I think we'd think that was a change in accounting policy, but we need to look at the words that we've got, I think, in the draft to make sure that that was captured.
Yeah. But as I said, we'll do more testing definitely before we proceed with the exposure draft. But that's where I was IS2. So.
Could I come in there maybe on the examples points as well? Because... first of all, specifically on the IFRS 2 point, that there is no wording we're going to get for the distinction that's going to solve the IFRS 2 question. IS2, sorry. Thank you. And that would not be useful as an example because it won't help in any other situation. So if we want to spell it out, we have to spell it out directly, I think. We can't do it as an example. Personally, I question whether we actually need to do it because I wonder how often people actually change from FIFO to weighted average or backwards, but I mean, I guess that's an empirical question. If people tell us it's happening a lot, maybe we need to address it. On the other examples, I'm not actually sure what we would achieve with examples. We could put in simple, non-controversial ones, in which case we're probably not adding anything. or we could put in the more difficult cases. And one thing that worries me about putting in the more difficult cases is that we might be implying that there's some difficulty today, or that we have a different view today about where the distinction is than it where it might be tomorrow. And I'm not sure we necessarily want to do that. So I have some doubt about whether adding examples will really help very much. But that's something we can consider. The other difficult question that we've the other difficult individual case that's come up a lot in the discussions is there's an issue in IFRS 19 about discount rates for pensions. Mm-hmm. And that one is also very closely linked to the specifics of that standard. It's not particularly useful as a more general example, which also means it's probably not going to be very helpful to illustrate how the distinction really works.
Okay, Steve, you had two more comments.
Yeah, I do. Well, I've got another comment on this. Somebody mentioned that is the accounting policy to measure a cost, or is it to measure using a particular variety of costs? And that, to my mind, means that this question is wider than simply FIFO versus weighted average.
Yeah.
And that's why I'm nervous about solving it just in IS2. Mm-hmm. My second comment was on this threshold. So this paragraph 34A, a number of you have said don't like having the threshold. Does that mean we take it out? So we only leave the first sentence of paragraph 34 and delete the rest? Or do you think there should be something there? I mean, the idea was to provide some constraint in flip-flopping valuation techniques. So are we going to be silent on that? Or put something in, but just not what we've got? So I'd like to hear your thoughts on that. And then my last question is for Andreas. You mentioned that recalibration of a model, and if the recalibration was large, it might mean a change of accounting policy. I was surprised. If I have a model which I'm using to calculate fair value, and if I change the model, or if I recalibrate the model, but my objective is still fair value, to my mind, all of that's a change in accounting estimate, even if the recalibration is big. Maybe it could turn into an error at some point, but I don't think it's a change of accounting policy.
I agree with that. My suggestion was more to make it explicit in that round, because okay. Calibrations is probably a very frequent form of updating estimates.
Right. Okay.
Right. Yeah.
Cedric?
Just a quick comment, because we generally are supportive of the clarification, even if it was not identified as a matter of concern by the French constituent, this differentiation. The only point which was raised was, but it has already been expressed, is the question of limiting the definition of accounting policies to specific principles. That means what shall we do with practical expedients or interpretation, or even interpretation rejection. So that's also a matter that should be maybe clarified. And just a final minor comment on the appendix. On A13, there are three columns in the presentation. Maybe it is a bit confusing, because it leads to thinking that valuation technique may be different from an accounting estimate. So that's just a minor comment.
It's a subset, yeah.
Sue?
I just wanted to build on the question that Stephen asked about the threshold for changes in techniques, because I think there's another variant as well, which is thinking that whether or not it's better to have some sort of default criteria in IS8, which is sort of what the draft is doing, or whether we're better to rely on something that's more specific in the circumstances we're thinking about. So I'll use IFRS 9 as an example, as I always do when I can. In there, we talk about people measuring expected credit losses, and there's a particular measurement objective. And I think contemplated in that is that people may change the approaches that they use over time based on facts and circumstances, but then we have particular disclosures, et cetera, that go with it. So I think implicit in there, we've thought about the fact that people can change techniques and rather put our reliance on the fact that as long as they're doing something that's consistent with the measurement objective, that's okay. So I guess that, and IFRS 13 already has guidance about what you do if you change measurement techniques. So we've thought about it in the specific circumstances when it arose. So I guess by being silent in IS 8, it doesn't necessarily mean we don't have criteria, they're just housed in specific standards. And then the question is, do we in addition need a default? And then what would we do where that might be different to what we've got in the specific standards?
Mary?
A comment related to both Sue and Steve's, and I think it comes back to both the origins of this issue and getting views of people around the table, that I think the origins come from more changes in techniques, and a simple example might be with IS 19 and the discount rate, which basket of entities you look to determine a high-quality corporate bond rate, as an example. And a growing awareness that changes in valuation techniques are increasingly significant and lack transparency. And that kind of set off the whole, is it a change in policy, is it a change in estimate debate? And I think the question we may have to answer more head-on than we do right now is our objective discipline around change in technique, or transparency around when there has been a change in technique, or is it both of those things? And I think the harder thing with discipline, and you know, we've got a proposal in paragraph 34-35A about what the discipline would be, is we've identified several instances just around the table today when, you know, whether it's cost benefit or other reason, that discipline might not always be good. But do we think we still need enhanced transparency around this when there's been this change? Because if you change actuaries or even stay with the same actuary and you change your basket, if that's what's driving the change in discount rate, does it matter to users of financial statements to understand why the discount rate has changed, or are they just focusing on the fact that there may have been a change in discount rate? So I think it's, is it transparency, is it discipline, is it both? And do you agree with, I think, the implication of this paper that there needs to be more guidance in this area of changes in techniques?
Transparency point, though, just on that. We have to be careful there too, right? Because, for example, the banks that are calculating expected credit losses will have potentially hundreds of different models that they're using. So when is it important enough that we need that transparency, I think, is an important question.
I think on that, when you go through the 35A through E examples, this stuff is evergreen. It just happens every closing period. There's some change in the underlying data, what's available, relative significance. And the basket, I mean, I used to run actuarial, is it changes every year. I mean, someone calls a bond issue, you know, it's no longer got the relevant duration. I mean, it's there's just constant change underneath all the underlying facts and dynamics. But that's just information, or just available information, you know, whatever you want to call it. But it's never ends.
Jay?
So to respond to your question, I just wonder whether this would be trying to regulate to a degree something which can't be done. Sort of to Gary's point, there are literally hundreds or thousands of potential, depending on what you think change to technique means, potentially thousands of those, and saying each one of those has to be equally or better representative, as opposed to does the new estimate comply with what's required by IFRS at any given point in time, and presumably in those areas where there are key inputs and judgments, those might be required. You know, the pension discount rate is required to be disclosed anyway. So do you need to know that I hired a new actuary and the basket that they look to happens to be, you know, include three different underlyings than the other basket, and here's the reason why, and here's why it is equally or better representative of versus, and the company didn't even think about that. They hired a new actuary, and then they looked and said, does the rate comply with what's required by IFRS? And so whether this puts a higher threshold than people could actually comply with in practice, particularly if it doesn't incorporate any notion of cost benefit, I don't think that's what happens in real life.
Andrew?
Yeah, a couple of brief reflections, firstly on this threshold question. I think IFRS 9 is a good example of a standard that has a pretty clear principle and lots of application guidance that I would say set out a sort of absolute threshold as to how and when an estimate is good enough. So if you've got an individual standard sufficiently clear absolute thresholds, then why do we need a relative threshold, which is what this is doing? It does seem like it's potentially something of a sledgehammer to crack a nut, if that phrase means anything to non-native English people. Entirely unrelated thought, relevant to the disclosure initiative, I wonder if we go with the definition of accounting policies as just principles, what that does to the disclosure of significant accounting policies that, rightly or wrongly, in this day and age tend still to get into depreciation periods and that kind of thing that I think would be accounting estimates. So if we're going to strip back the definition of accounting policies, do we need to kind of bolster the guidance on disclosure of accounting estimates to avoid a loss of important information, which is something to think about?
But what we're doing doesn't change the fact that an estimate of a useful life is an estimate and always has been an estimate.
Yes, so perhaps I chose a poor example, I think my more general point is that back in the old IAS 39 days, you rarely found it, but it was quite interesting to understand how companies were applying a significant or prolonged threshold for impairment of equity instruments, for example, which I think is probably an estimate, not a policy. So as good information we're currently...
Fortunately, that's gone.
I do know that. That's what's uncontroversial, so I can mention it for safety. My point is, is an unintended consequence going to be a loss of useful information in the first part of the financial statements?
Can I just pick up on the issue of disclosures briefly? Because we did discuss this issue with the board, I think it was also in April, as a separate paper, board paper. And basically, the discussion went along the lines that IS 8 and individual IFRS standards require very substantial number of disclosure requirements for changes in accounting estimates. For example, IAS 16 explicitly requires to disclose reasons and changes for useful lives and depreciation methods. So it's already there. And so I think we have to be a little bit realistic, not a little bit, but just have to be realistic in terms of how much we can do as a standard setter in terms of building up disclosure requirements and what can be done in practice, and like whether regulators, auditors, and preparers should be also contributing to this, overall disclosure initiative, so to speak, in terms of providing relevant and sufficient information. So I personally don't think we will be losing out on anything, because as I said, there are many, many disclosure requirements across IFRS standards for changes in accounting estimates.
Okay, well, thank you. Good enough to work with, Nadia?
Yeah, I think so. I'm sensing that people are supportive for, just final question, of batching this exposure draft with some other document.
Yeah. Okay, very good. Thank you very much.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you.